I am David Pickford. I am the youngest of a family of 5 boys and 2 girls. We were all born in the Bell in Great Eastern. My first memory of the war was sitting on the triangular grass outside Great Eastern Village Hall, because a bus had brought evacuee children to the hall and anybody who had a spare room came to get the children. I was looking forward to some boys to play with, and then Mrs. Buster Brown had 2 boys, Harry and Lenny Bridges, who were about my age, who became good friends, and I played with them every day after school, except Mondays, when Mrs. Brown did her washing, and while the copper was hot, they had to have their weekly bath. The Gibsons at Patel's had the 2 Atkinson brothers. Bob Farrow at the Green Man, Milton Green, had Ronald and Donald Sleeth. And as he had riding ponies, the 2 boys helped looking after the ponies, and at school, they ran around hitting their backsides with a stick as if they were geeing a horse up. Mrs. Tyler had their sister Daisy. Nearly everybody had a child, but I can't remember the names of the others. School was alternated between the school buildings and the village hall. The village children had either mornings at school and afternoons in the village hall, or vice versa, the following week. After a few weeks, a lot of evacuees returned to London, so by using the staff room, we could all get into the school again. Air raid shelters were built on the right-hand side of the school with escape tunnels on the ends. We had to practice crawling out in the dark as there were no lights in the air raid shelters. There were also blast walls in front of the school doors. One morning, Bonnie Harrison turned up at school, having been bombed out in London. He sat next to me and we have been mates ever since. To start with, we spent our spare time collecting scrap iron, which was piled on the village green, and paper that was stored in a garage at Snow Hill for the war effort. In summer, we killed white butterflies with twiggy sticks as a form of pest control and collected rosehip syrups, I think as a supplement for vitamin C because there were no oranges. French letters, condoms, were everywhere. One thing I remember is a boy called Rofi. I think his real name was Edward Townsend. He put one on a tap in the seniors' cloakroom at Eastern School. He filled it with water, and it was about 4 foot long, running across the floor. Us boys all stood round, and it burst just as Mrs. Langman, the headmistress, came in. The floor was flooded, and I think Rofi got the stick. At lunchtimes, I would leave school at 12 o'clock to have my lunch at home. One day, I started down the school path, got by the big oak tree on the right-hand side, and heard a bang above. Pieces of aluminium fell from the sky. 2 hurricanes had collided. One came down at Neville's Farm, Millen Green, and the other beside the cottage with a pump at the front of Great Eastern. The Home Guard was formed with Captain Steele, who was at the relief of Mafeking in the Boer War, in charge. People started making hurdles in Brewer's Mead, which I think were going to be put out to hinder gliders if they landed. The river was dug out with a big willow tree by the side of the ford cut down. Tank trap was dug between the river and Croy's Grange. Concrete bollards were built on the Cox Hill side of the ford with fixings for steel cables. There was a manhole with a small tunnel going under the road. I think the idea was to enable the road to be blown up if necessary. The pillboxes were built. Black Oak was imposed with Frank Sage, was the air raid warden. His son was killed at the beginning of the war as a Wellington bomber pilot, and is mentioned in a book called Bomber Command Continues. He would go around the village on his bike, blowing his whistle when the siren went, and round again, ringing a bell for the all clear. I think Bolly Rolfe did the same at Dewton Hill. My father took me to see where the bombs had dropped at Debden and a Dutch barn that was hit at Pleaston Hall. Mrs. Capel of Essex House woke us up one night, calling, "Fred Pickford, can you come? Because there is a bomb on the house." My father got us all up, and we had to go down the garden and lie down behind a bank while he went to see what the trouble was. The bomb we were all frightened of, the bombs we were all frightened of, was a landmine that came down by parachute. I think I must have thought it was an unexploded landmine. As it turned out, it was an unexploded incendiary that had gone through the roof. So we put it in a bucket of sand, took it outside in the garden, and we went back to bed. For a time we slept downstairs under a big table. That didn't last long. We all went back to our beds again. One night a bomb dropped between the river and Battelle's. A bomb hit an oak tree in the corner of the field opposite Hill Farm, and an oil bomb dropped in the same field. There was also a stick of bombs dropped over Broom Hills about the same time. To the best of my knowledge, there are still two unexploded bombs in Deer Wood. When London was firebombed, you could see the glow in the sky from the village. Chelmsford had also bombed on a Thursday night, so there was no cattle market on the Friday. Buster Brown, who drove the cattle float, had to bring not only the cattle and pigs, but also the chickens and rabbits that he took for people in the village. Nearly everybody kept either a pig, which I think we were allowed to keep half of, or chickens, rabbits or goats. Posters were put up for Dig for Victory and warning us not to touch personnel bombs because some of them looked like toys. Len Legend was unfit for military service, so he was sent to London repairing bomb damage. He told my father about some building materials being sold off, so my father went to London and took me with him. I remember the underground station having bunk beds down the sides. When we got out into the street, a crane with a big steel ball was knocking down the walls of burning buildings. Lorries were carting the rubble to clear the street and dumping it in a park. It was a huge heap of rubble, with lorries driving it up it and tipping the rubble at the top. My father left me with a policeman while he went into one of the buildings that was not very safe. The policeman had to go and left me alone. I was not very happy. First, my brothers Tony and Bert went away to the Merchant Navy because my father thought they would be better off there than in the trenches, as it was in the First World War. As nearly all my father's workmen had been called up, or those unfit for military service had been directed to war work, he rented Bush Farm, Gallows Green, next to Hyde Farm, that my brother Jack was farming as a dairy farm. I remember going to the meadow behind Blanchard's Hall, where there were about 20 or 30 heavy horses. They were brewery dray horses that had been brought out of London because of the Blitz. My father, with other farmers, bought some for working the land. As was a huge shire horse called Kitty. She did a lot of work, such as carting corn, horse hoeing sugar beet, nearly everything except ploughing, for which we used Fords and tractor when we could get it started. Kitty had a foal. There she was in milk when we were using her for horse hoeing beet one day. I was leading her up the roads when the hoe broke. Tony sent me down to the farm to get a bolt. When I got back with a bolt, he had a bottle of milk, and he said he'd been down to Jack's, who had a dairy farm, and got it from him. I drank some, and it tasted sweet, so I told Tony. He said, yes, Jack put some honey in it. I found out later he'd milked Kitty, and that was what I had to drink. When the horse was shot, I was put on its back to take up to John Rolls, the blacksmith. He was sure, then put me on its back to take home. Tony was home because he had been taken very ill with peritonitis in Buenos Aires. He was in hospital for some time before catching another merchant ship home. He was now C3, unfit for military service, so he stayed at home and worked the farm. I thought this was great because I had someone sleeping in the bedroom again. It had gone from a bedroom sleeping five boys to just me, which had got very lonely. Things got better when Tony came home because he poached pheasants that he shot with a catapult at night. He made his own lead balls, about a half inch in diameter, that he used in a catapult, and they made no sound. He always went out when there was very strong wind and it was raining, because that was when the pheasants sat lower in the trees. He also shot young rooks when they first came out of the nests and sat on a branch before flying. My mother would skin them and use the legs and breasts to make rook pie. The first Americans that came were engineers to Easton Lodge to clear the park and build an airfield. There were explosions all day long as they cut down the trees and then blasted out the roots. To start with, they couldn't understand why we didn't take any notice when the siren went, but they soon discovered most of the time there was nothing to worry about. I went with my father to see him line the concrete runways and infrastructure. They worked in shifts 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I took about 13 months from start to finish. The first airfield that opened was Salling. The first American aircrafts that went there were B-17s, Flying Fortresses. After a very short time, they changed the Marauders B-26s, the same as Eastern Lodge and Stansted. We learned to know which airfield they were from by the yellow markings on the tails. The Americans were very good to us children. We'd go into the cookhouse and they would give us dinner, even if they sometimes put the sweet in the same compartment on the tray as the main meal. I even had ice cream sometimes at the camp, something we never saw at home. One day we went in for a meal and they said, "You kids are not having anything to eat today unless you do some work for us." So they put a bucket load of hard-boiled eggs in front of us and told us to peel them. We were peeling them. One of the boys was Bernard Chapman. He was eating as many as he peeled. He must have been very constipated. The other thing we did was to go through the dustbins, because when someone was shot down, they threw most of their stuff away. Most of us kids specialise in different things. Sweets, badges, models, clothes and shoes. My personal speciality was shoes. My mother would sell them for me in the pub for 10 shillings a pair. We learned to live with explosives. There were 50 calibre bullets everywhere. We learned that the black tips were armour piercing, and when the copper covering was taken off, they made a very good centre punches. I still have one. Blue tips were tracers, and if you scratched a piece of lead out behind the bullets, stuck it in the ground, put a match to it, it'd go up like a flare. Red ones were explosives. We didn't play around with them. The beer quota came into the pub on a Thursday. By Sunday, it was normally sold out, so the Americans would buy bottles. On a Saturday morning, I had to go and pick up the empty bottles with my handcart and take them back to the pubs. I got threepence a bottle for this. The bomb dumps caught fire when the Marauders were at Eastern Lodge. So for several days, there were explosions until they finally managed to put the fire out. When the bomber crews were confined to base, Southern always broke curfew, and when MPs came, they would hide in one of the private rooms in the pub, or my mother would put them down the cellar. The only time no one came out was the night before D-Day. My father said something big must be happening, and sure enough, when the planes came home the next morning, they were all painted in black and white stripes. The crashed planes were dumped on the left-hand side of the road above the Manor Ponds, and we would get aluminium and perspex for making rings, brooches, models and all sorts. When the Americans left for France, they were limited to how much kit they would take, so they had to dump a lot of their personal things, such as sheets and clothing. I collected a lot up, put them in sacks, then borrowed my brother Frank's pony and cart the next day to bring it home. Once again, my mother sold it all for me in the pub. My sister Ruth drove a small pickup truck, and she went round the army camps picking up the swill, waste food, which she took to Maysland Farm, where it is cooked by steam being blown into tubs. This was then fed to pigs. Every able-bodied man or woman had to do some form of work. If they had no job, they would be directed to some form of employment. On the evening of D-Day, just about everybody in the village went to church. It was the first time I'd ever seen Great Eastern Church full. For VE Day, we built bonfires on the village green with great celebrations, which was all repeated for VJ Day. When we killed a pig, it had to be salted. This meant my mother broke up big blocks of salt that we had to rub into the pork, making sure we got it into the corners next to the bones. She then laid it in a big earthenware pots, covering each layer with salt. If you had a cut on your finger, this made it very sore. Eggs were also preserved in earthenware pots in the spring and summer using something called water glass, I think. Farmers had to use a percentage of their land to grow sugar beet. The only seed drawers they had to put the seed in, far too thick. This meant they had to be singled by hand. This was done by a man walking down the row, cutting through rows approximately over 6 inches. The women and children then went behind, pulling the remaining beet out and just leaving the strongest plant so that it finished up with one beet plant every 6 inches. The field was then horse-hoed between the rows to keep the weeds down. At harvest time, a beet lifter moved them enough so they could be pulled and knocked together to get as much dirt as possible and thrown into heaps. Workers then came along and cut the tops off and threw them either straight onto a cart or back into heaps again. A lot of the work was done by Italian prisoners of wars. About 20 would be dropped off at the farm in the mornings with only one guard. They would work all day in the fields and be picked up again at night. If they could catch a rabbit or anything edible, it would be skinned and put in a pot to eat. When the German POWs came, they had two guards for every 10 prisoners. Later on, some of the prisoners of war lived on the farm. I used to feel sorry for the Italian prisoners pulling beet on frosty mornings in what looked like very thin clothes with no covers apart from the trees and the hedges when it rained or snowed.